Good morning. So Emperor Wu came to Bodhidharma and asked him a couple of questions. His first question was, okay, I've built lots of temples. What is the merit in having built all those temples? And Bodhidharma said, empty, no merit. And then Emperor Wu says, well, who are you standing before me? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. So it's a principle within Buddha Dharma that we really don't know who we are. So who do you think you are? That was all built up. Hi, welcome to our group. What's your name?
I am called Jeff.
You're called Jeff. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Why don't we tell Jeff, each of us, who we think we are? I think I'm right.
Elizabeth.
Melinda.
Maren.
Pam.
Patty.
Janine.
Dan.
Okay. Welcome, Jeff. Glad you could join us. So, at the end of the talk, we will recite the four vows. Now, would anyone like to recite them for us now?
We didn't hear.
Okay, here. So, at the end of the lecture, we'll recite the four vows. And Patty will recite them for us now.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
So those are in the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism, in some form or another, those are the four bodhisattva vows. They're based on the Four Noble Truths. You know, save beings from suffering. There is suffering. Suffering is caused by ignorance, by thirst and desire, born from ignorance, delusions that take care of those. The order is different because the third noble truth is nirvana is peace. There is an end of suffering. And so that's the Buddha way is what we're going to attain. And the fourth noble truth is there's a path to the cessation of suffering, or to, in the Mahayana, the attainment of Buddhahood. And that's the Eightfold Noble Path, the Dharma gates. And so the order is a little different, but the four vows are directly based on the Four Noble Truths. But they're different from the Pali version of committing to the realization of the Four Noble Truths, because they're stated within a context of paradox or impossibility or limitlessly vast. Beings are numberless, infinite. You know, they may be finite in, you know, how many five, six, however many billion we have on this planet, but that's just this planet, and my vow is not limited to this planet. The numberless beings, I vow to save them. I vow to bring them to liberation, to freedom from their torment, their sufferings, their stress, and their limitless, and I'm going to take care of all of them. Delusions, desires are inexhaustible. I'm going to kind of cut through all of them. So that's the spirit of the vows, has that feeling of impossibility to it. Welcome.
I'm so sorry.
Okay.
No, don't be sorry. Be welcome. And, you know, Norman Fisher, my teacher, he's recently been talking on the Lojong teachings, which are a particular way of cultivating power. And he's been saying lately that people come to Zen Center for the first time, and then to hear the talk, And at the end, there's these vows, and people, you know, come in for the first time and they say these things. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, you know. The Buddha way is unattainable, I vow to attain it. And he says, I wonder what they think. I wonder what they're thinking when they say that. Are they thinking at all? Or are they thinking, what the heck is this? You know. Or there may be a few who say it and something just, a fire gets ignited in your consciousness. That's my, I think that, you know, there may be a number of reactions to hearing the vows for the first time. I think one is you're just reading it and not, you know, say, oh, well, this is, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. This is part of the ritual, it's part of the bells and whistles, and I'm not here for bells and whistles, I'm here to sit, so I don't care. Some measure of indifference might be a response. Some measure of, this doesn't make any sense, might be a response. Or there may be a somewhere deep inside a feeling of yes. I've been talking about the vows a lot lately. And Zazen, independent of vow, is not Zazen. It may be some other practice. It may be meditation. It may be learning meditation. But the Zazen I speak of, and the Zazen that Dogen speaks of, is not simply meditation. Zazen without vow is not Zazen. As I contemplated uttering these words to you today, the thought occurred, well, if I say that, maybe they won't come back. No. And so I thought, well, yeah, but it's the truth, so I have to run that risk. But let me say this, if you're not ready to practice Zazen, and you want to come here Saturday and sit and meditate with us, please feel welcome. Suzuki Roshi, to his own students, says, some of you here are practicing, you know, we are Mahayana Buddhists, but some of you here are practicing Hinayana way, not Mahayana way. That's a way where we sit. The Hinayana way, that's kind of a pejorative, polemic term, so forgive me for I'm quoting him, he used it. Theravada would be a more respectful term for the older form of Buddhism. But the lesser, and it means lesser vehicle. Mahayana means greater vehicle. That's the polemic. But the polemic also expresses some fundamental worldview differences, so it's not just polemic. There is some in the evolution, I like to think Buddhism evolves. As we evolve consciously as beings, we get more subtle and more careful in our understanding of how to live in this world and how to walk in this world, then our understanding of the Dharma needs to evolve. And so I see it as an evolution. I'm digressing quite a bit right now. But so Suzuki Roshi said, we are Mahayana Buddhists, but some of you here are probably practicing Hinayana way, not Mahayana way. And I don't think he was meaning to say that as a criticism, but just as an acknowledgement. If we're in a state of profound stress or suffering or confusion, it is very appropriate to desire to learn how to take care of that. And so that's the caveat to the statement that if it's Zazen is not Zazen without vow. If you come in and you cannot find it in your heart yet to make this vast, inconceivable vow, and you come looking for some peace, please come. It's okay. But the essence of vow in the Mahayana is so important for the welfare of our world that I feel compelled to try to elucidate it. And if you have a problem with the vows, you're not alone. I want to share a dialogue between Suzuki Roshi and one of his students. And my intention today is to try to go from a rather rarefied, sublime understanding of vow in its deepest sense, as best as I can, down to a very, very visceral, graspable approach to practicing vow. So to demystify it for our daily practice so that we can incorporate it readily and we don't have to just say words that have no context to our daily experience. That's kind of like the task that I set out for myself. Wish me luck. So this is the conversation between Suzuki Roshi and his student. No, it's not. But it will be soon. I just got to change books here. Oh, but no, go ahead and read this part first. This section is from Okamura Roshi in his book Living by Vow. And it elucidates what I was saying before about the vow is stated in this context of paradox or impossibility. He goes on to say, as we said, there is a contradiction inherent in these vows. We vow to do things that are impossible. This means that our practice is endless, and we cannot completely fulfill the four vows. Our practice and study are like trying to empty the ocean with a spoon. Empty the ocean with a spoon. One spoonful at a time. It is certainly a stupid way of life, not a clever one. A clever person cannot be a bodhisattva. We are aiming at something eternal, infinite and absolute. No matter how hard we practice, study, and help other people, there is no end to it all. When we compare our achievement with something infinite, absolute, and eternal, it's like nothing. So there's that one reading, and there's a whisper of something important that I hope to get clear on later. And that is, in the Mahayana context, we don't practice, our liberation is not hinging upon enlightenment, awakening. Our liberation is hinging upon vow. There's this word in theology, soteriology, the theory of salvation, what is provocative of salvation, and one soteriology is that the shedding of Jesus' blood on the cross for the sins of the world is how, and accepting that in our hearts is how we get saved. So that's what that word means, soteriology. The soteriology of Mahayana is not, I'm going on record to say, and maybe I'll get in trouble, is not enlightenment, it's vow. We actually vow to postpone our Buddhahood and make our liberation contingent upon the liberation of all sentient beings. And we're not going to accept it unless everybody can come with us. Because that is what will free our hearts. So that's the understanding in Mahayana. What liberates us is not the awakening, but the vow. The vow culminates, we pray, hope, you know, in universal awakening. But if awakening is what frees us, we'll never be free. But if thou is what frees us, we can be free on the spot, right here, right now. And so that's what I say, and I'm going to try to get more into that, maybe. I'm not quite sure where I'm going to go today. But that's when he says we are aiming at something eternal, infinite, absolute. He's hinting at the fact that thou saves us. Thou liberates us. Thou gives us our freedom. Thou is what allows us to touch the eternal, infinite and absolute. So, now I want to share this dialogue between Suzuki Roshi and the student. Then see where we're at. So the student says, in light of what you said earlier, I don't understand the vows. If there are no sentient beings, why do we vow to save them? It sounds like a joke, a big joke. Suzuki Roshi, that is because your practice is always confined within the realm of why do we practice Zazen? What does it mean? Actually, your practice is very good. Why do you practice so good? I don't understand. And he laughs. It doesn't feel so good to me, she says. Anyway, actually, you are doing quite well. My lecture may be some enticement. It may be better for you not to listen to my talks, just practice Zazen. Student, I don't mind Zazen so much, but I don't like to make promises I don't understand. If sentient beings are numberless, or desires are inexhaustible, you cannot say I vow to save them. Our promise is very silly. It doesn't make any sense. I agree with you, but still we do it. Why? Because we don't feel so good if we don't work for others. We take the four vows, but what we mean is more than that. For the sake of convenience, we just say the four. But I feel really, truly lucky that we have inexhaustible desires and numerous sentient beings to save. And also, that it's almost impossible to save each of them in the terms of, I saved you. You cannot save in that way. Whether it is possible or not, whether it is the Buddhist or Bodhisattva or Hinayana or Mahayana way, is not the question. Anyhow, do it. That is our vow. When I promise to do something, the student says, it has to have some meaning. If it doesn't have some meaning, I can't say it. That is your arrogance. I don't know, maybe, but you're crying. Even though you are crying, that crying doesn't make any sense. Your effort is still based on some selfish practice. You don't give yourself up. You have to suffer and fight more with yourself. There's no one to fight with and nothing to fight with. Fight with your selfish practice until you give up. That is the most important point for real students. They shouldn't fool themselves. They don't want to be fooled by our teaching or by Zen or by anything. That is right. They shouldn't be fooled by anything. Student, well, what will I do at the end of the talk when we chant the four vows? Everyone will chant the four vows and I won't believe them. You don't have to believe in them literally, because various teachers and numerous people recite them. You should do it. If they are cheating themselves, you should do it. If they are cheating themselves, you too should be cheated. You should be fooled along with all sentient beings. That you cannot do it means that you want to be a special person. That is good. That much spirit we should have, but that is not our way. My answer is very cold. I cannot be sympathetic with your practice. Maybe some great teacher will give you some candy. Go and get it. So this is a long interaction, and I'm looking at another page here. But I think it's good to stop there. That is the essence of the dialogue. Her rational mind can't get around the four vows, and she's honestly troubled by that. And Suzuki Roshi's trying to push her further, further, have a deeper grasp of why these are so important. And it's hard to understand why these are so important, but they are so important. Just trying to be good is not going to cut it in this world. Shanti Deva says that virtue is so frail, and he uses the word evil. Evil is so strong that goodness gets buffeted about, knocked around, and just trampled on by evil, left and right. I'm paraphrasing here. Except for perfect bodhicitta, there is no hope, basically, he says. So just to be good is insufficient. We need to crack open the atom. We need the spiritual equivalent of E equals MC squared in order to face this world. And therein lies the reason for this paradoxical dynamic and being stupid enough to commit to it, to release that energy in this world. That's what it's about. And I'll call on Suzuki Roshi to help me verify that in a moment. But first, I want to do a time check. And then I want to tell you the story about Hakuin Zenji. I think he was kind of contemporary with Dogen, a little bit about the same time, but in the Rinzai tradition. If the historian here knows better than that, you can correct me, but that's my sense of it. I'm not much of a scholar or historian. But one day, and I think this is not apocryphal, I think it actually happened from all the things I've read, this father of this woman, this father and daughter and little baby come up to Hakuin. And the father is furious and said, you impregnated my daughter, you filthy hypocritic priest. So you should take care of the baby. And Hakuin says, is that so? Hakuin takes the baby. A year or so later, I forget what it says, the daughter has a fit of remorse because she lied. She lied because her boyfriend is the father, but she feared that if she told her father the truth, he would slay the boyfriend in his rage, and so she blamed it on the priest. So in her fit of remorse, she confesses to the father. The father has his own fit of remorse, and they go traipsing back to Hakuin, and just, oh, we're so sorry. I'm so very sorry. Now we falsely accused you. And please let me take my daughter's child, and we'll take care of the child. And Hakuin says, is that so? Now, the thing about this story, when it's usually related, when I hear usually told, I like to tell it differently. Because usually when I hear it told, there's a tone of the cool, aloof, detached Zen master who is unmoved by praise or blame and just, you know, too cool to be touched by that. And we can't actually confirm or deny what was going on in Hakuin's heart and mind, but I like to conjecture differently that, yeah, he felt some anxiety. Hey, I've got a reputation in this town, and it's going to go to hell in a handbasket now. What are my students going to think? Well, you know, will I be able to stay housed if, you know, I can't, you know, do takahatsu and get sustenance? What's going to happen to them? He's a human being. I see Hakuin as a human being, not as some different kind of being called Zen master, but a human being under vow. And so he had to perform some damage control. Now, if I vigorously deny being the father, this man is not going to believe me. He's probably going to get further enraged. If I refuse to take the child, what will be the future of that child? What is the karmically least harmful thing to do now? How do I save all sentient beings now? How do I stay true to my knowledge of the importance of that? And not some mystical coolness, I feel, is what motivated Hakuin to just say, is that so? And to accept the circumstances that presented themselves to him. So there's one example, one example of living in vow. And it involves uprightness in the midst of pain. And that, and that's, and so hold that image, uprightness in the midst of pain. Maybe sit upright a little bit more. and then sometimes when the dynamic of vow is taught, it's in Okamura Roshi's book, and I've heard it elsewhere, it's taught thusly that ordinary beings are beings who are driven by karma. Bodhisattvas are beings who are driven by vow. So it's about what is propelling. One way of looking at it is that we can't opt out. We can't opt out in the sense that we are, our life energy is flowing into the world, having effect on the world 24/7. We can't remove ourselves from the game and choose not to have any effect on the world. If we're alive, we're having an effect on the world. How often do we, in the moment, take responsibility for that fact? The way our consciousness is manifesting right now, the way our bodily posture is being held right now, the thoughts that we're having right now, are not contained within some discrete thing called a self. It's perpetually flowing out into the world. How often do we take responsibility for that fact? What would it look like to take responsibility for that fact? Ordinary beings, hold those things loosely, ordinary being versus bodhisattva. We're all ordinary and we're all bodhisattvas. So it's just an illustration of a point. It's not a category of person. Ordinary beings are driven by karma. Ordinary beings take no responsibility consciously for their conduct. It's driven by habit. It's driven by desire. It's driven by irritation or anger. It's driven by habit. Bodhisattvas are living from a deeper place. It's not that they're free of desire. It's not that they never experience irritation. It's not that they never experience anger. But they have no ashravas. Ashravas. That's a Sanskrit word which means outflows. They have all the stuff, but they don't permit it to flow out into the world. How do they do that? They have this vow. They choose their actions of body, speech, and mind according to vow, not according to habit, not according to affliction, not according to anger, not according to desire. So that's one way of understanding how to bring it a little bit closer to home, how to live in vow, and how to actually find some measure of freedom as a result of being a person of vow. What prompted my desire to study and clarify and vow again more deeply was I was at Starbucks before meditation in San Rafael, and this young woman was in Starbucks, and I got up to go to the bathroom, and she was standing up there, and as I walked by her, her shoulders were hunched up and held tightly to her body. And there's this look of being perpetually hunted in her eyes, is how she appeared to me. And then I saw her again in the parking lot when I was about to leave, walking across the parking lot. That same impression came upon me, that this poor woman seemed to be kind of like always in fear. And then I thought about it, and then the question came up for me kind of randomly, which came first? The inner experience, the inner state of mind of this woman, or the posture? Was the posture a result of what was going on in her heart and mind? Or was what was happening in her heart and mind being driven by her posture? And I was just kind of playfully thinking this over. And it occurred to me that in Buddha Dharma, you can't say which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Could you repeat that, please?
In Buddha Dharma, you can't say which came first, the chicken or the egg. According to Buddha Dharma, it's a mutual co-arising. Everything causes everything else. It's not a linear causation. It's a in-the-moment mutuality. And so it's hard to say. Does the posture drive the mind? Or does the mind drive the posture? And then as I was thinking about that, I thought about what's it like to sit upright in the midst of anxiety? If we're anxious, we could be driven by that anxiety. We could be an ordinary being driven by our karma. Or we can sit upright and we could feel, there's a sensation in the solar plexus here. There's certain thoughts that I was having that I think may have resulted in this feeling that I have here. So we're not being driven by our karma. When we choose to be upright in the midst of what's going on, we're not determined by what's going on. We're not ignorant of it. We're not wild foxes. We're paying close attention to what's going on. But we're not being determined. Our being, our state of mind, our state of being is not being determined by what's going on. And that is how. Very simple, very plain, very ordinary. But not so easy to do. One thing about it is when we're upright in the presence of, say, anxiety, we feel it more directly. It's painful. We feel the pain of it. We feel the suffering of it directly. If we do this, self-protective posture, and if we kind of like spin out our stories of how we're being victimized, that's somewhat numbs the direct apprehension of the pain. But it also sustains the being of anxiety. When we sit upright and attend carefully to what's happening, but do not permit ourselves to be determined by what's happening, we have some measure of freedom. And Tozan has a poem. The blue mountain is the father of the white clouds. The white clouds are the children of the blue mountain. All day long, they depend upon each other without being dependent on each other. The blue mountain is always the blue mountain. The white clouds are always the white clouds. So the blue mountain is Vow in the midst of the clouds of suffering. So we're upright and the clouds are there, but we are not dependent upon the clouds. We are not determined by the clouds. Mm. We're living from a deeper place than our habit, than our suffering, than our affliction. And it's a very simple practice of smiling. Thich Nhat Hanh likes to encourage people to smile. And oftentimes they resist. Well, that's not enough. I don't feel like smiling, then it's fake. Well, it could be fake or it could be vow. It could be the determination not to be determined by your suffering and to vow to live from a deeper place. To have the courage to be in the presence of suffering, one's own as well as others. And not bite. with some sense that biting, either small bites or big bites, keeps that wheel of suffering spinning. You know, and if we've lived a decade or two, we kind of sense that when we get angry and say something snarky at somebody, it doesn't help. It just kind of keeps the friction going. But when you can hold the pain with dignity, it tends to dissipate. The discord tends to dissipate. So I mentioned, I'm going to wrap up soon. This is a fairly long talk. Bear with me, I'm going to wrap up pretty soon. I mentioned earlier about vow being the soteriology of Zen, the path of freedom or the path of liberation in Zen. And I want to share, in closing, what Suzuki Roshi says about vow. Each vow expresses one of the four Buddhist vows. These vows are, although sentient beings are innumerable, we vow to save them. Although our evil desires are limitless, we vow to be rid of them. Although the teaching is limitless, we vow to learn it all. Although Buddhism is unattainable, we vow to attain it. So he phrases it a little bit differently, which heightens the paradoxical nature of it. If it is unattainable, how can we attain it? But we should. That is Buddhism. To think, because it is possible, we will do it, is not Buddhism. Even though it is impossible, we have to do it because our true nature wants us to. But actually, whether it is possible or not is not the point. If it is our inmost desire to get rid of our self-centered ideas, we have to do it. When we make this effort, our inmost desire is appeased. Is appeased, and nirvana is there. Before you determine to do it, you have difficulty. But once you start to do it, you have none. Your effort appeases your inmost desire. Can you hear here how vow is clearly a path to great freedom and a peace that is unconditioned, not contingent upon an electronic fountain and the shakuhachi music coming into a great sound system, but a peace that can be present in the midst of the fire. That is why vow is so important. For us Buddhists, it is the path of mercy for all existence, the path of peace that is imperturbable. And the only thing that I have any faith can stop the fires in our world. That foolish, stupid, limitless, I'll do it. You want me to empty the ocean with a spoon? Well, I don't know how long it's going to take, but if it's really helpful, I'll do it. Okay, that's my talk. It'll take maybe a few minutes for any reactions, comments, or questions. Nobody ran out of the room screaming. So.
I'm just going to say something that I walk, or have started to walk like an old lady, and my children will say, stand up straight, you know, and I look at all, and of course in teenage years you did it for one reason, and then as you get older you just do it naturally because you're tired, and all of a sudden I went to a class, and it wasn't just holding your shoulders back, it was pulling your, wings, what is it, down, and it was
scapulas.
Something, yeah, so instead of going like this, you do it lower. And I've been trying to do it daily, and it is doing just what you've told me. It makes me a different person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's all I want to say. I'm not an old lady.
Yeah, which came first, the smile or the shift in depression? Because I have been practicing that. I've been practicing smiling even if I'm stressed from work. I'll say, oh, geez, I'm stressed. Maybe I should smile at you. Quite smiling with stress. And then I'll be doing that and feeling a little mechanical about it. And then I'll walk into some place and people smile at me. Mm-hmm. And, hey, oh wow. And so, I don't know.
Yeah, I just, I had an inside, I can't remember when it was now, but 2 years ago. A lot of my practice has been, I guess, Hinayana in the way Suzuki Roshi talks about it. But it occurred to me that there is no awakening on one's own, which is exactly what the Bodhisattva vow is about. Mm-hmm. There simply isn't. It simply can't happen.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that thing I just said about my smile, even though I don't want to, and then I walk in some place and I feel people or see people smiling at me, you know, that seems to be an illustration of that. You know, because when that happens, then I feel more genuine. Mm-hmm. And it's no longer a contrived or forced smile. It's not, it kind of like the effort kind of like dissipates. And that's why I'm convinced for myself that the so-called Theravada Mahayana distinction in worldview, for me, is illustrative of an evolution of understanding. It's not that it's right or wrong, it's just a little bit more subtle, a little bit more sophisticated than what actually our human condition is and how we can lessen our suffering and have some measure of peace and fulfillment in life. It's not right or wrong, it's what really works given the truth of things.
Yes, sir. And I think it's Matthew, what the heck is his name?
Ricard? Matthew Ricard.
Yeah, he was the biologist, he is now a Tibetan monk. Mm-hmm. And he says also that happiness is through service. Mm-hmm. That's the way you attain happiness, is by serving others. Yeah. And Joko Beck said to me once the exact same thing. I said, what's the point of all this? And she said, to serve others. Mm-hmm. But I've never heard it, so I want to thank you for that. I've never heard it put in the terms of vow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to reiterate the point I'm trying to drive home, but E equals MC squared. And like Shanti Davis says, that virtue is frail compared to evil in this world. Mm-hmm. It takes bodhicitta, which is the vow, to actually confront the intensity of the evil. And that's why this paradoxical dynamic. Yeah, I'll empty this ocean with a spoon. I'll be stupid enough to do this. Because that's kind of like, uranium. It actually, it's that softens up the hardness of things so that we can split through that kind of, foolishly intense commitment. Releases something that is more fundamentally powerful than mere goodness.
The intention is more powerful than the actual goal.
Yeah.
Than the result.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Process.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, so this vast inconceivable vow to save all sentient beings, when you want to flip somebody off on the freeway and you remember your vow and you feel your suffering directly rather than let it flow out, it's all fulfilled right there. The vast inconceivable vow of saving all sentient beings is fulfilled by refraining from raising that middle finger.
Raising the
middle finger.
Oh.
Yeah. because of the place from which it's coming is so deep, it touches something deeper than individuality. Shall we do it? You ready?
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Shudro Muhen Se Dando Bono Mujin Se Dandan Om Ryo Se Gaku Butsudo Mujo Seganjo. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.